Usually, when we picture a cyber attack, we imagine someone, kicking down the digital front door,
Right.
like a brute force password spray, or maybe a zero-day exploit just crashing right through the firewall. It's loud, it's direct, and the security operations center typically sees the alarms going off the second it happens.
Exactly. The bells and whistles start immediately.
Yeah, but today's intelligence reports, and we're looking at a desk full of them, dated May 28, 2026. They show us what happens when attackers completely abandon that front door approach. Instead, they decide to just quietly poison the town's water supply. You wouldn't even know you were under attack until you already took a drink.
Which is a terrifying prospect, honestly.
It really is. So we've got a desk full of supply chain nightmare scenarios for this deep dive. Three distinct threats today, but they all highlight how threat actors are realizing it's far more efficient to just compromise the source.
Yeah, we are looking at a fundamental shift in the economics of exploitation here. Because kicking down the door, as you said, requires expensive 0 days, you have to navigate heavily monitored perimeters. But compromising the supply chain, whether that is the actual developer writing the code, the IDE tools they use to build it, or even the mobile ecosystems we all rely on it, just offers unparalleled leverage.
Yeah, because you're bypassing the perimeter entirely.
Exactly. You bypass it because you're already inside the house.
Okay, let's unpack this, starting with the human element of that supply chain.
Sure.
Because researchers at Wiz just published this report on a financially motivated threat actor. They're calling them JaeonX0164.
Right. Active since mid-2025.
Yeah, mid-2025. And they are hunting cryptocurrency developers. But what's wild is they aren't going after the firm's cloud infrastructure.
Right.
They aren't trying to breach their AWS instances.
No, they're going after the developers directly.
Yes, via highly credible LinkedIn recruiter profiles.
And the social engineering here is it's incredibly tailored. They aren't just mass mailing phishing links to everyone at the company.
Right. It's not a spray and pray.
Exactly. They identify a specific crypto developer, they approach them with this lucrative, entirely believable career opportunity, and they schedule a virtual interview.
Okay.
The trap is sprung when the target clicks the actual meeting invite. They're steered to a rogue domain that, well, it perfectly mimics a standard teleconference provider.
So it looks totally legit to the developer.
Completely. And once the page loads, it throws a fabricated technical error. It basically says, hey, your audio is broken, and it prompts the victim to download a fix from a spoofed domain.
Right. And that domain is apple.driver-store.com.
Yes.
And I mean, the psychology of that lure is what makes it so dangerous. It's like a digital Trojan horse.
Yeah.
But instead of a giant wooden statue, it's an invitation to a dream job on Zoom. You're a developer, you're minutes away from a high-stakes interview for a massive payout, and your browser tells you your audio is broken.
It creates instant panic.
Right. It provides a link that says Apple Driver Store. You aren't thinking about OPSEC in that moment. You're thinking about not looking foolish on this very important call.
Yeah, but wait. These are highly skilled developers being targeted. How are tech-savvy people falling for a fake audio driver download?
Well, what's fascinating here is how panic completely overrides technical training.
Yeah.
The attacker creates this high-pressure artificial time constraint. The developer downloads the supposed fix, which actually drops a custom macOS malware called AudioFix.
Okay, audio
Yeah,
fix.
it's a Python-based info stealer, but it's very clever about its persistence. It masquerades as a legitimate system audio driver, specifically Cori Audio, which, perfectly aligns with the fake Zoom error they just experienced.
So the victim opens their activity monitor, sees an audio process running, and thinks, oh, great, I solved the problem.
Exactly. But under the hood, it actually saves itself as Chrome Updater and executes via Launchdraddle.
Okay. For anyone dealing with macOS forensics, using launch daemons and agents is the standard way to guarantee the malware spins up every single time the machine boots.
Yep. And AudioFix doesn't come alone. It drops Minirat right alongside.
Minirat. Now that's a Go-based backdoor, right? It is. Researchers actually found it previously hiding inside a legitimate DeFi toolkit NPM package. So once Minirat and AudioFix are both running, the blast radius on that developer's machine is total.
Wow.
The payload immediately targets their password managers, iCloud keychains, crypto browser extensions, and critically, it hijacks active session tokens for Slack, Discord, and Telegram.
Okay, let me stop you there because grabbing session tokens for Slack and Telegram is a massive escalation.
It's
They aren't
huge.
just talking about draining the developer's personal MetaMask wallet here. With those active tokens, the attacker can just impersonate the developer in internal company channels.
Exactly, bypassing multi-factor authentication entirely.
Because the session is already authenticated.
Which is the ultimate goal. I mean, JONX0164 uses that compromised endpoint to pivot laterally into the company's internal code distribution systems.
Right, getting into the CI/CD infrastructure.
Exactly. They want to modify the source code of the crypto firm's actual product before it ships out to customers.
That is just wild. Now, Wiz noted that these tactics, you know, the fake recruiters, the intense focus on cryptocurrency firms, the specific spoofing domain patterns, they look remarkably similar to North Korean state-sponsored clusters, like BlueNoroff.
They really do. They even observed the attackers using Astral VPN.
Which is a known North Korean TTP.
Yes, a very well-documented one.
But Wiz stopped short of formal attribution. Why hold back if the playbook is, like, identical?
Well, attribution is just notoriously difficult when financial motivation is involved.
Fair.
While the tactics mirror BlueNoroff, Wiz confirmed there is absolutely no current infrastructure overlap connecting JINX0164 to Pyongyang.
Oh, really? No overlap at all?
None. And we have to consider that highly successful tactics are frequently commoditized. This could easily be a completely distinct financially motivated group just adopting a proven North Korean playbook simply because it yields consistent results.
It's the cybercrime equivalent of corporate espionage. If your competitor's marketing strategy works, you just copy it.
Precisely. Why reinvent the wheel?
But, you know, hacking developers one by one via fake Zoom links, no matter how effective it is, it doesn't scale infinitely.
No, it's too manual.
Right. If you want true planetary scale leverage, you don't just target the human. You compromise the open source tools they use every single day.
Yes.
Which brings us to our second story and explains why CrowdStrike, Google, and the Shadow Server Foundation just had to coordinate this massive takedown of the infrastructure powering a threat called Glassworm.
Yeah, Glassworm operates on a completely different magnitude. Since early 2025, these operators who are assessed to be Russian speaking based on card comments and geographic execution checks, they have systematically poisoned over 300 GitHub repositories.
300. Wow.
Yeah. And they targeted software developers by trojanizing VS Code extensions published on the Microsoft VS Code Marketplace and OpenVSX.
Okay, that OpenVSX detail is critical.
Yeah.
Because that means they are hitting developers who use popular VS Code forks, things like Cursor, Positron, VS Codeium.
Yeah.
And a lot of enterprise developers use those forks specifically to bypass restrictive telemetry or licensing in the vanilla Microsoft build. So an attacker drops malicious code into a seemingly legitimate syntax highlighter or a deployment extension, and the developer just willingly installs it.
And when that poisoned extension runs, it executes with the full privileges of the developer.
Right.
From there, Glassworm deploys GlasswormRat. It's a WebSocket-based JavaScript remote access Trojan, and it drops alongside a rogue Google Chrome extension.
Okay, so a RAID and a Chrome extension.
Yeah. And the credential harvesting is extremely aggressive. They grab GitHub tokens, NPM access tokens, cloud infrastructure keys.
Oh, wait, if they already have access to the developer's environment and they have their NPM tokens, why go through all the trouble of deploying a heavy WebSocket RAT and a rogue Chrome extension? Couldn't they just scrape the source code, steal the tokens, and disappear before they get caught?
Well, they could, but that limits their return on investment. Scraping tokens is just a one-time payout.
Oh.
Deploying GlasswormRat allows them to convert that infected developer's high-powered workstation into permanent covert infrastructure. The compromised host literally becomes a SOCKS proxy, a hidden VNC server, or a remote execution node.
Oh, wow.
They integrate the victim's machine into a global botnet.
So the victim's machine is not just bleeding data. It is actively weaponized to launch attacks against other targets anonymously.
Exactly. Routing traffic through a legitimate enterprise IP address.
Which lets them bypass geofencing and IT reputation filters.
Precisely.
And to maintain control over this massive botnet of developer machines, Glassworm built an absolutely wild command and control architecture.
Yeah.
I mean, this is the part of the CrowdStrike report that is truly staggering.
It's next level.
They didn't just rent a server in bulletproof hosting. They built a decentralized, multi-layered C2 network.
The resiliency they engineered is top tier. I mean, let's look at the channels. First, they hid their server addresses in the memo fields of transactions on the Solana blockchain.
Let's break down the mechanics of that because it is brilliant evasion. The Solana blockchain is a public immutable ledger, right? Anyone can read it.
Right.
So when Glassworm wants to update the IP address for their botnet to phone home to, they just execute a tiny cryptocurrency transaction. And they paste the encrypted new IP address into the transaction's memo field.
Yep.
The infected machines on the developer's laptops are programmed to constantly query that public wallet address. It essentially acts as an untakedownable, decentralized DNS server. You cannot issue a subpoena to the blockchain to shut down a wallet.
You can't. It's permanent. Furthermore, they use the BitTorrent DHT peer-to-peer network to retrieve configuration data.
Oh, we're blending in with regular file sharing.
Exactly. Blending their command traffic into the background noise of millions of file sharing nodes. And then, for their final layer, they use Google Calendar event titles as dead drops to fetch C2 addresses.
Using Google Calendar and the blockchain to control malware sounds like a sci-fi villain's backup plan. Why go through all this trouble?
Well, if we connect this to the bigger picture, it's all about the blast radius.
Okay.
Compromising one developer's workstation gives attackers access to thousands of downstream users. The barrier to poisoning a package is low, but the payout is massive.
Right.
Which is exactly why Glassworm invested so heavily in a resilient, multi-layered C2 network. They have to protect their access.
Because it's like a spy ring, where nobody knows the headquarters address. They just read the classified ads in the Sunday paper to know where to drop the stolen intel.
That's a great way to look at it.
If law enforcement burns down the newspaper, the spies just switch to looking at graffiti on a specific subway train. The malware checks Google Calendar via the official API. To a corporate firewall, that traffic doesn't look like malware phoning home. It just looks like a developer checking their meeting schedule for the day.
Exactly. And the combination of these techniques makes neutralizing the botnet incredibly difficult. If security researchers sinkhole the primary IP, the malware just checks Google Calendar. If Google purges the calendar, it queries the Solana blockchain. It requires a perfectly timed, multi-party operation to sever all communication simultaneously.
Which is exactly why the coordinated effort between CrowdStrike, Google, and Shadow Server was necessary.
Yes. They severed all four channels at the exact same moment, completely stranding the infected machines.
It's a massive win.
Mm-hmm.
But it highlights the terrifying reality of that blast radius you mentioned. A single poisoned VS Code extension compromises a developer. That machine is then used to poison an open source NPM package,
mm-hmm.
which is then downloaded by thousands of downstream organizations, embedding that malicious code into commercial products.
Huh.
The scaling economics for the attackers are undeniable.
They really are. And we have to recognize the life cycle of these techniques, too. What we see in cybersecurity is a relentless trickle-down effect.
Oh, for sure.
Elite groups pioneer these resilient, decentralized infrastructures. They pioneer these legitimate traffic evasion techniques. But those tactics don't stay confined to enterprise espionage.
No, they always leak out.
Give it 12 to 18 months, and those same advanced evasion methods are commoditized, packaged up, and deployed against everyday consumers.
Which bridges us directly to our final intelligence block. The techniques we just discussed at the enterprise level are currently hammering everyday consumers across Latin America and Europe.
Yes, we have new findings from WatchGuard and ESET.
Right. Simultaneous findings on two major banking Trojan campaigns. Grandrero targeting Windows environments and BTMOB destroying Android devices. Let's start with Grandrero.
Okay, so Grandrero is a fascinating study in persistent adaptation. It has been active since 2016, heavily targeting financial institutions.
And currently, its primary crosshairs are on Portugal and Mexico, right?
Yes. Brazilian authorities actually launched a major operation to dismantle its infrastructure earlier this year, but the operators simply evolved their loader mechanisms.
Of course they did. So the latest variant uses a technique called DLL sideloading, relying on files compiled in Delphi 11. Specifically, they're abusing a file named libweb.dll. Let's dig into how that actually bypasses execution policies.
Sure. So Windows operating systems rely on dynamic link libraries, or DLLs, to execute shared code.
Right.
When a legitimate executable launches, Windows searches for the required DLLs in a very specific predefined directory order. It generally checks the directory where the application is installed first.
Okay.
The Grandrero operators drop a legitimate signed executable onto the victim's machine. but they place their malicious libweb.dll in the exact same folder.
I see. So when the legitimate program runs, Windows blindly grabs the malicious DLL sitting right next to it, loading the malware directly into the memory space of a trusted process.
Exactly.
Your antivirus sees a signed trusted application running, completely unaware that it just loaded a malicious payload.
Yep. But the persistence isn't even the most concerning update to GranArrow. It's how they are hiding the communications back to their servers.
Right. This is where it connects back to what we were saying about hiding in plain sight.
Yes. They have integrated libraries that support WebRTC. Specifically, they're routing their command and control traffic over the STUN and IC protocols.
Which means they're hiding in the loudest, messiest traffic on the internet. Because WebRTC and those HDN and ICE protocols are the exact underlying technologies used for NAT traversal by Zoom, Microsoft Teams, WebEx.
Exactly.
It's how peer-to-peer audio and video find a path through firewalls.
And when the GranArrow malware talks to its operators, the packet capture looks nearly identical to standard video conferencing traffic. It's high-volume UDP data that firewalls are explicitly configured to allow through to ensure smooth video calls.
Wow.
This raises an important question. How can surface-level enterprise defenses, and certainly consumer-grade antivirus, differentiate between a malicious command payload and a 10.0 AM marketing sync?
They can't. They're just hiding in plain sight using the protocols we implicitly trust. And while GranArrow is using WebRTC evasion on Windows, the mobile landscape is facing something arguably more invasive.
Yeah, let's talk about Android.
ESET's tracking of the BTMOB Android Remote Access Trojan shows a terrifying level of device control. It spreads through fake Google Play Store apps, usually linked from streaming sites or cryptocurrency phishing pages.
And the infection chain hinges entirely on abusing Android's accessibility services.
Accessibility services.
Yeah. These services are originally designed to help users with disabilities by, you know, reading screen content or automating taps.
Right, like screen readers.
Exactly. But when a victim installs a fake BTMOB app, it aggressively prompts them to grant accessibility permissions.
And the second the user clicks allow, it's game over for that device.
Utterly. With accessibility rights, the malware can interact with the UI on behalf of the user.
Wow.
It can dismiss security warnings, grant itself further administrative permissions, and intercept two-factor SMS messages without the user ever seeing a single prompt on the screen.
That's terrifying. ESET noted it can capture screenshots, log keystrokes, and even live stream the device's screen to the attacker.
Yes. They specifically highlighted its ability to capture Alipay pins. It basically records the screen while the user inputs their payment details.
Unbelievable.
It can also just quietly mine cryptocurrency in the background, draining your battery while you scroll through social media.
But, you know, the capability isn't even the real story here. The real story is the business model powering it. BTMOB is actively being sold on X, formerly Twitter, by a threat actor named EVLF. It operates as a full-fledged malware as a service.
Right. EVLF isn't just selling a virus. They are providing a comprehensive turnkey business operation.
A business in a box.
Exactly. The subscription includes a web-based operator panel and a custom APK builder. A buyer can generate new payloads, customize their phishing lures for specific geographic regions, and manage their infected devices through a clean UI without needing to write a single line of malicious code.
And the pricing tiers are remarkably accessible for the damage it causes. You can rent the entire BTMOB infrastructure for $700 a month. You can buy a lifetime license for $1,200. Or, if you want to completely control your own destiny and avoid the monthly fees, you can purchase the complete server source code for $7,000. So what does this all mean? It's basically a dark web franchise model. You don't need to know how to build a digital bank vault drill. You just rent one with an easy-to-use interface.
Yeah, this drastically lowers the barrier to entry for cybercrime. But the ecosystem took a massive turn in December 2025.
What happened?
An Italian cybersecurity firm, D3 Lab, reported that the entire BTMOB development toolkit leaked online.
Wait, the whole thing? The builder, the source code, the operator panels?
Everything. D3 Lab's analysis revealed that EVLF was functioning as a service provider, strictly enforcing licensing and authentication on their customers to protect their revenue stream. But when that toolkit leaked, all those licensing checks were bypassed.
Oh, wow.
The underground market was suddenly flooded with the unadulterated source code.
So instead of paying EVLF $700 a month, any script kiddie with a grudge and basic server knowledge can spin up their own elite-level Android banking Trojan for free.
Exactly.
It is the absolute democratization of advanced cybercrime. And it's unleashing a wave of copycat campaigns across Latin America and Europe.
The downstream effects of that leak are what we are seeing in the wild today. When enterprise-grade evasion tactics trickle down to the consumer level and the tools to deploy them become free, the sheer volume of attacks increases exponentially.
Absolutely. So, bringing all these threads together, what does this mean for our operational mindset?
Yeah.
The takeaways from today's intelligence require a massive shift in how we evaluate trust. First, regarding the human supply chain, the GINX 0164 campaign proves that context is a weapon.
Right.
If a recruiter pulls you off a trusted platform into a proprietary video conference that immediately demands a software update to fix an error, you need to recognize the artificial urgency. Attackers are manufacturing panic to bypass your technical logic.
And second, the Glassworm takedown demonstrates that our trusted ecosystems, you know, VS Code extensions, NPM packages, open source libraries, these are active battlegrounds.
Yeah.
The concept of implicit trust in software development is dead. You cannot assume an extension is safe just because it is hosted on a legitimate marketplace. Rigorous verification, dependency mapping, and zero trust execution environments are no longer optional.
And finally, regarding consumer devices and the fallout of BTMOB, Android accessibility services are the keys to the kingdom. Treat any application asking for those permissions with extreme prejudice.
Absolutely.
A flashlight app or a PDF reader does not need the ability to read your screen or simulate taps. Because as the BTMOB leak showed us, the capability to completely hijack your digital life is now freely available to anyone who wants to compile it.
Exactly. I mean, consider the overarching trajectory we've mapped out today. Threat actors are engineering resilient, decentralized infrastructures, hiding command servers and public blockchains, and API calls to Google Calendar. They are burying their communications inside the stun-in and IC protocols of normal web traffic, and they are sideloading into trusted software execution paths. If the tools used to build our software are compromised at the source, and the malware hiding within them is structurally indistinguishable from legitimate network traffic, are we approaching an event horizon where we can never truly cryptographically verify the safety of any software update, no matter how pristine the source appears?
That is a staggering implication. I mean, if the water supply itself is fundamentally untrustable, the entire foundation of how we build and deploy technology has to be re-architected.
It really does.
Thank you for joining us for this deep dive into today's intelligence. Remember, in an environment where the supply chain is the primary target, continuous skepticism and staying informed are your absolute best defenses. We will be back tomorrow to analyze the next wave.